Dry Prong is a small, isolated community nestled in the dense woods of Louisiana.
Small towns seem like they're safe. It's a close-knit community, and that's really appealing for people that especially want to raise a family.
When a crime this insidious happens in a small community, people are shocked.
This type of crime is almost sadistic in nature. Not only did they inflict the damage, but they watched their victim suffer for weeks. Money is a very powerful motivator, and this is really just for a few dollars.
Dry Prong, Louisiana is a small town with a big problem. There's a killer on the loose. Could this killer be one of their own? Dry Prong, Louisiana, named after a water wheel that came up bone dry in the 1870s. It's home to less than 500 people, a village right off Highway 167, approximately 20 minutes from Colfax, Louisiana. Life here is quaint. Families here look forward to the annual Pecan Festival. Hunting and fishing is a year-round pastime. And with two churches and a school, Dry Prong is perfect for raising a family. But it is in the quaint, isolated community of Dry Prong that a family is destroyed, shattered by a gruesome series of events. Barbara Smith is only 31 when she moves back to Louisiana from Texas. Barbara returns to her hometown, a broken-hearted widow, with three children to raise. Despite her tough circumstances, she quickly becomes a part of the community by joining the local Baptist church.
Barbara lost her husband at a very young age and returned to her hometown with her three children. She raises her children on her own. She's known to be a great mother, a hardworking woman, and everyone in the town loves her.
Barbara finds a job as a manager at a bakery and stays for 24 years until she retires, raising and supporting her children on her own. Two of her three children, Dennis and Kimberly, venture off into the world, but her son, Marlon Keith, returns to Dry Prong to care for her.
Marlon Keith Smith. He was well-liked and respected. He was a hard-working, dedicated employee at an auto body shop, and he took care of his mom.
He has worked at the same auto body shop for 15 years, a steady, skilled, and reliable employee.
Keith is a really well-liked member of this community. He's a skilled auto mechanic. He also lives with his mother and takes care of them, and both of them are really well-liked in the community.
He's an auto body guy and he has a very meticulous work ethic. People have to come to see him and he knows, you know, a large number of people in the community.
Hardworking and personable church-going folk.
Prior to the fall of 2003, Keith is spending most of his time caring for his mother, working at his auto repair shop, and basically living a very quiet life. In the fall of 2003, he meets Betty Ann Findlay at a bar.
Soon after meeting, Keith and Betty begin dating, and they find themselves inseparable.
Well, their relationship progresses very quickly. Very soon after meeting one another, they're talking about moving in together.
In February 2004, just months after meeting, Betty moves in with Keith. It seems to be working. Keith, the perpetual bachelor, is finally in a relationship.
Betty also helps Keith in caring for Barbara and visits her all the time and is generally very helpful in that way. So it seems like she's fitting in very well with the family.
But soon, things start to go terribly wrong. Despite being a skilled auto body technician, work is sparse in the Dry Prong area. It becomes evident that Keith is going to have to look for something else to make ends meet. Nine months after Betty moves in, Detective Seduth of the Grant Parish Sheriff's Office receives a phone call. Billy Nugent, Keith's uncle and Barbara's brother-in-law, hasn't seen or heard from Keith in 3 weeks. In response, Detective Seduth calls Betty. Betty explains that Keith is in New Mexico working on a construction site and has been since October.
Betty tells investigators that Keith is working in New Mexico and that he usually calls to check in every Wednesday. She tells police that she'll ask Keith to contact Billy and let him know he's okay within the next few days. So Billy decides that he's going to wait to see whether or not Keith calls and give Betty the benefit of the doubt before making a formal missing persons report.
When it comes to filing missing persons reports, every jurisdiction is a little bit different. They typically expect a member of the family or a very close friend or somebody who knows the missing person very well to make that report.
After speaking with Betty, Detective Seduth checks back in with Billy Nugent. Billy mentions something else to the detective, that Keith's mother Barbara has been experiencing strange medical issues. Billy is very close with his sister-in-law.
Billy also tells officers that in the past month or so, Barbara has been experiencing a large number of health issues, and he's actually obtained a power of attorney over her. So what a power of attorney does is it gives someone else the ability to make financial and medical decisions for someone who doesn't have the capacity to do that for themselves anymore.
He checks in on her daily. He recounts the events of the past month to the detective. In the late fall of 2004, Barbara becomes sick, showing strange symptoms. Barbara's speech is slurred and she has a difficult time walking. Over the next few days, according to Billy, Barbara's symptoms become progressively worse. Betty visits often to help care for Barbara.
This is unusual for her, and they finally make the decision to take her to the hospital to get her checked out.
Doctors examine Barbara, conducting tests to determine what is causing the strange symptoms. But at this point, the doctors are unable to determine what's wrong with her. After some time in the hospital, Barbara's symptoms improve.
They're ultimately unable to determine what the problem is, and they have no option but to release her and send her home.
With the help of Billy and his wife, Barbara's sister Carol, Barbara returns home, seemingly in good health. soon, Barbara becomes ill again. Barbara gets sick, goes to the hospital, gets better, comes home, and the whole cycle starts again.
So it certainly seems like there's a pattern here. Barbara gets sick again, goes back to the hospital, and gets better again. Eventually, Barbara goes back to the hospital, and they finally run a series of toxicology tests.
The results are quite shocking because it finds that she has various amounts of pills that are in her system, such as opioids, and the prescription medication that Barbara is on does not match what the toxicology shows within her bloodstream.
She's a 71-year-old woman, and the number of opiates in her system is indicative of either hardcore abuse or that something else is going on.
The family suspects that Betty is involved with this somehow, but actually, Betty has been under investigation for some time now, but not for poisoning Barbara.
Dry Prong, Louisiana, population of almost 500. For Barbara, it's been a month of mysterious symptoms and repeated hospital visits. The toxicology screen reveals that Barbara has high levels of opiates in her system.
While all of these health issues are occurring for Barbara, Keith, who was her main caregiver, vanishes.
Keith's uncle has informed Detective Seduth that no one has heard from Keith in 3 weeks.
For him not to be returning home to assist her when she's in medical distress certainly seems strange and is very out of the ordinary.
Betty tells him that the two are low on funds, and so Keith is in New Mexico working on a construction project. Keith will call them in about a week. Both Keith's family and detectives wait for his call. But Betty is already on the detective's radar for something else. There's been a report of bad checks signed to Barbara's account. This causes detectives to take a look at Betty's records. They discover that 10 years prior to meeting Keith, she was charged with multiple counts of fraud. They see that she has a history of forging checks from her place of work and attempts to withdraw money under fraudulent circumstances.
In 2002, Betty was charged with identity fraud, and she was convicted and sentenced to 1 year of hard labor.
A year after being released from prison for fraud, she meets Keith.
So what Keith was unaware of when he met Betty was that she actually has a criminal record and has actually spent time in jail for those offenses in the past.
Individually, the offenses themselves aren't overly serious. But when you take into account the fact that they are repeated over and over again, it could point to the fact that you're dealing with a serious habitual offender.
After Barbara's toxicology report and Betty's criminal history come to light, Billy checks Barbara out of the hospital and takes her directly to his house.
Billy takes her straight to his house, and Betty actually attempts several times to go visit her there, and Billy stops her from coming in order to protect Barbara.
Barbara soon makes a full recovery and does not have any further symptoms.
So in November 2004, Barbara is going through her checkbook and discovers that 5 checks have been forged from the checkbook. She did not write these checks.
At this point, investigators believe that Betty has been stealing checks on her frequent visits to check up on Barbara. Barbara worked her entire life for the little money she has. The $3,000 Benny steals from her is probably almost everything she has. The family also believes that during these same visits, Betty has been poisoning Barbara.
The belief is that whenever Betty visited Barbara, not only did she obtain the checks and forge them, but she was also slipping some sort of intoxicant into her tea.
A week after Billy's initial report, neither family nor detectives have received the promised phone calls from Keith. It's time to open a missing persons report. That report changes things in terms of the investigation. It gives investigators a lot more leeway.
So at this time, the investigation into where Keith is and where he has been this whole time kicks into high gear.
Betty has stated that Keith was out of work when he went to New Mexico to make some extra income. On November 19th, a subpoena is ordered and Betty's phone records are pulled.
This entire time, Betty has been claiming that Keith has been in New Mexico. But an examination of the phone records reveal absolutely no calls to or from New Mexico at any time.
Investigators had their suspicions, but now they have the proof. Betty is lying.
The question at this point is, where is Keith? Nobody seems to know.
4 days after the phone records are pulled, detectives receive a tip from a confidential informant. The tipster relays the location of a possible gravesite. And for Betty, it is very close to home.
In a missing persons case, when you have no idea what's happened to this person, it's very important that people come forward.
We refer to these people as tipsters. They call with all types of what they think is important information, and police have to be cognizant of all of it, and they need to take it all into account. But this particular information is very specific, and it relates to what could potentially be very damning physical evidence.
So in this case, an anonymous tipster contacts police and tells them that they saw a strange hole in Keith's backyard, and also testify that they saw two bloody pillowcases being removed from the residence. Not only does the informant tell the police about the two stained pillowcases, but actually delivers the stained pillowcases to the police.
Detectives quickly obtain a search warrant on Keith's house.
When police attend the house with a search warrant, they threaten to kick in the door after not getting any answer. But finally, Betty comes to the door claiming that she was in the shower. But it was pretty obvious to the detectives at the time that she wasn't in the shower. Her hair was dry. There was no sign of having been in the shower. Depending on what is being searched for, the officers or the detectives would conduct a very meticulous, methodical search of the area that is of concern. They would document everything they've searched, as well as documenting everything they find that they believe is relevant to their investigation. Now, if they do find evidence, it's very important to establish this chain of custody if they want to present it in a court of law. It's very important that they can establish that nobody else tampered with any evidence that they would have located. The tipster was actually correct. There was an anomaly in the backyard. It did appear that something had been buried back there.
In the dug-up area, police notice a pungent odor. They also find a number of items, including hair and an extension cord.
Betty tells detectives that before Keith left for New Mexico, he killed a dog, and she guesses that the hole in the backyard is where he buried it.
Officers send the found items, including the hair samples, away for testing. Even though authorities discover what looks like a grave in her backyard, they still don't have enough to arrest her.
At this time, detectives don't have enough evidence to charge Betty in relation to Keith's disappearance. However, they do have enough evidence to charge her with forgery. So at this time, they charge her with forgery so that they can at least hold her in custody while they continue to investigate Keith's disappearance and also keep her away from Barbara.
On December 7th, Betty is arrested on a total of 16 counts of forgery, gathered through two separate investigations by two counties. She is taken to Rapids Parish Jail. Two days after the arrest, a surprise visit will lead to a major break in the case and possibly exonerate Betty of Keith's disappearance. Betty's sister, Janet, arrives at Detective Seduth's office unannounced.
Betty's sister, Janet, had just visited Betty in prison, and she has now come to the police to provide them information.
She relays to Detective Seduth what Betty told her in confidence. Betty is finally ready to tell investigators what happened to Keith. Janet relays that Betty told her a man named John killed Keith. Janet explains that she, in fact, knows John very well and had been in a romantic relationship with him, as had Betty.
Well, Janet reveals to the police that he's a very violent person. He's threatened them in the past. He's used these threats to manipulate and intimidate them.
She discloses that John had beat her on multiple occasions. John had been abusive to Betty in the past. Janet knew this for a fact. Given this new information, John's violent past corroborated by an outside witness, this is a vital new lead.
Now, after the police speak with Janet, they immediately request an interview with Betty, and she gives them a full rundown of what transpired that night.
John shouts at Betty that he wants the money that she owes him. She tells him that she doesn't owe him any money and demands that he leave.
Betty shares that there was a violent altercation between Keith and John, and that Keith received a gunshot wound.
When the shot ran out, Betty freaked out and ran into the woods.
Betty claims that she hides in the woods for hours, waiting for John to leave. She finally hears a car start and drive away. She hides for another few hours, then returns to the house. Betty knows something terrible has happened.
After the gunshot and a few hours have passed, Betty returns to the home, and she finds that Keith isn't there. She does see blood, and she cleans it up, but she doesn't say anything to anybody. She's afraid that if she says anything, John will kill her family. He's threatened this in the past, and she thinks he'll do it.
Betty goes so far to call Keith's place of employment the next following day that he goes missing and tells his work that he will be sick for the day.
Betty says she noticed that Keith's handgun was missing after he disappeared. She assumed that John had used it to kill him.
Betty tells police that it's possible that John dug the hole in the backyard while she was hiding in the woods, tried to bury Keith in it, and then discovered that the hole was too small. She also tells police that John drove a black Jeep and that he definitely arrived and left in that Jeep that night.
A quick search shows that a black Jeep is registered to John.
The story that Betty tells officers at this point does seem credible. This person, John, does seem to exist. In fact, he owns a black Jeep, which is registered to him. So it does seem likely that he is a person of interest in this case.
Betty's recounting is credible enough that investigators now have a new suspect on their hands. Days after interviewing Betty, Detective Montgomery speaks with John.
The police go talk to John, and John tells the police that he did date Betty about 2 years ago, but that he broke up with her when he discovered that she was forging checks from his bank account.
Detective Montgomery then tells John of the allegations Betty made against him. He seems baffled. He claims he didn't even know Betty was living in Dry Prong and hadn't seen her in a year. Obviously, he could be lying about not knowing where she lived. So Montgomery asks him what kind of car he drives. John says a white Ford pickup. He claims he had driven a black Jeep 3 years ago when he was dating Betty.
With respect to the vehicle, he acknowledges he did in fact own a black Jeep, but that he had sold it to a friend 3 years ago or so. But his wife unfortunately had an accident with it and the vehicle was written off, so it's no longer on the road.
John provides the name and phone number of the friend and the license plate number of the car. Later, it all checks out. The Jeep was wrecked 3 years ago. But Betty doesn't know that. She thinks John still drives it.
When you look at all these details that John has provided, they do seem to jive somewhat with what Betty is saying, but really her story isn't adding up at this point.
Betty is clearly lying to the police. As investigators shift their focus back to Betty, Detective Montgomery receives another surprise visit from Janet. This time, she literally delivers the keys to the case. Dry Prong, Louisiana. The area is known for its 54-year-old Pecan Festival. Dry Prong and the surrounding communities converge on Colfax every first week in November. For what's become a major attraction that celebrates pecan farming and harvesting in the area. But not everything here is idyllic. There's a new development in the disappearance of Marlon Keith Smith. Betty's sister, Janet, tells police that Betty has relayed to her what actually happened on the night of Keith's disappearance. An ex-boyfriend of both Betty and Janet, a violent, abusive man, visits Betty and shoots Keith. The only other suspect in the disappearance of Keith Smith, Betty's violent ex-boyfriend John, is cleared by authorities. Days later, Janet pays a second visit to the police station. She tells Detective Montgomery that she's just come from a visit with Betty at the jailhouse. Janet begs Betty to stop lying and tell investigators everything she knows.
Janet is wanting the truth. So when they sit down, Betty provides Janet with three keys.
She tells Janet that these are the keys to storage lockers and that in one of those lockers, she's going to find Keith.
Betty should not have had these keys in prison. How she got them there, no one really knows. Prisoners often smuggle things into jail or into prison.
Betty calls Janet, unaware that she is with a detective. Janet gently asks her sister which facility she should look in. Betty tells her, Unit 124. Debbie used the name Mary Trent to rent it.
So investigators seek out Unit 124. Investigators that are at the scene don't even have to enter before they smell a very pungent and offending odor coming from that unit.
Detective Montgomery applies for the search warrant while the scene is secured.
In the storage locker, they find a plastic bin with some garbage bags in it.
Investigators open up the bags and they find human remains, but the human remains are not intact. They have been cut up into pieces.
Despite the evidence and testimony that this is indeed Keith Smith, an autopsy must be done to verify the remains. Unfortunately for the Smith family, investigators confirm that this is the body of Marlon Keith Smith of Dry Prong, Louisiana. For Keith to have met such a gruesome end, it would have been devastating for them. By all accounts, Keith was a good guy, a devoted son, and a hard worker. For him to have met this kind of end is horrific. It would have been devastating for Barbara. Despite the horrific discovery, detectives aren't able to secure an interview with Betty for another 6 weeks.
Definitely is an admission that she knows where Keith's body is. Whether or not that's definitely admission of what happened to him or that she knows what happened to him or was responsible for it is a bit more of a question.
In the meantime, investigators collect more vital evidence.
Detectives start to interview Keith's neighbors to see if any of them noticed anything on the night Keith disappeared. One of the neighbors tells police that on the night Keith disappeared, Betty actually came over to borrow a chainsaw, and when she brought the chainsaw back, there were traces of blood on the blade.
Items that displayed potential blood splatter are taken under warrant from the home.
As the investigation continues, it was revealed that a prior lover and boyfriend of Betty's was given a handgun by her because she phrased it that she was fearing for the safety of her grandchildren and no longer wanted to be in possession of it.
Investigators then speak with Betty's adult children. They claim they had no knowledge of Betty's actions. But her son shares that he saw her get rid of a piece of carpet and was curious why she was throwing it away.
So it seems like there's a lot of what we would say is circumstantial evidence stacking up against Betty and Finley.
While it's all circumstantial, all these individual points, the gun that's gone missing, human remains being found, the sighting of her throwing out a carpet, tie together in the sense that police now believe that Betty is responsible for the homicide of Keith Smith.
And finally, the lab results are in from the hair taken from the shallow grave.
So the strands on the hair that were identified and located within the shallow grave of Keith's backyard are confirmed to be human.
So while none of that is in itself determinative, as a whole, it could certainly lead to a finding of guilt.
On February 9th, Betty finally agrees to speak with the investigators. It's time for Betty to tell the truth about what happened on the night Keith died. After Betty hands over the keys, Keith's remains are found in a storage facility. Further investigation has uncovered more evidence, including an electric saw with what looks like blood on the blade. Police also collect blood splatter evidence from Keith's residence. Investigators interview Betty for the first time since the gruesome discovery of Keith's remains. At this point, it's time for her to finally come clean and tell the detectives what actually happened.
Betty now gives detectives a second version of events. In this version of events, Keith finds out that Betty's been forging checks from his mother's account. Heated argument ensues between the two of them, and during this argument, Keith grabs a gun. She lunges at him, and the gun goes off by accident, killing Keith.
Betty claims she lost her senses and didn't know what to do. And so she sat in the house with the body for hours.
She decides to wrap Keith's body in a quilt and drags it onto the porch.
Again, Betty doesn't know what to do and is scared, so she leaves him there for 2 full days.
She then decides that she's going to bury the body in the backyard.
So Betty buries Keith, but a week later it becomes pretty clear that the hole is too shallow.
This point is when Betty says that she went to the neighbors to borrow a chainsaw.
Betty then explains that a week after burying Keith, she rented a storage bin. The next day, she used the saw to dismember his remains and place them in plastic, then in the bin. The day after that, she took it to Unit 124. On December 23, 2004, 9 days after Keith's remains are discovered, Betty is transferred to the Grant Parish Jail.
So based on this new version of events, Betty is formally charged with second-degree murder. First-degree murder generally is murder with intent and premeditation. Second-degree murder is still culpable homicide, but generally it lacks evidence of the premeditation that's required for a first-degree murder charge.
You know, Betty's always been involved in somewhat petty crimes like identity theft and fraud, the forging of checks. Second-degree murder is a serious offense, and now she's staring down a life sentence.
On the same day of her arrest, Betty appears in the Grant Parish courtroom, where she pleads not guilty and is denied bail on the murder charge.
By pleading not guilty, Betty is saying that she wants to take these charges to trial, which may seem like a strange choice given that she's given a full confession. However, it is important to remember that everyone charged with a crime has the constitutional right to a trial, and you never know what's going to happen. Although, on the surface, it does seem like there's a strong case for the prosecution at this time.
But Betty still has one more ace up her sleeve. Betty is formally charged with second-degree murder for killing Keith Smith. She pleads not guilty. It seems like an open and shut case. Legally, you'd be pretty confident that the jury would find her guilty. But Betty tries one more time to evade punishment. On July 11th, 2005, Betty and her lawyers enter a new plea, not guilty by reason of insanity.
And what that means is that while a person is admitting to the elements of the offense, they are saying that by reason of their mental disorder, they are not culpable for the crime.
At this point, Betty's options seem to be running out, and the only thing that she feels can work is a plea of insanity. But an insanity plea requires that she prove that she was not capable of making a decision at the time of the offense, and that's going to be difficult.
3 months later, Betty's sanity hearing takes place.
So Betty has a hearing at which two doctors testify as to her mental state at the time of the incident. One doctor testifies that while Betty does have a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, this doesn't mean that she was unaware of her actions. A second doctor also testifies that Betty suffers from anxiety and depression, but again, these are not disorders that affect moral culpability for a crime.
It doesn't take long for the judge to determine that Betty is fit for trial. But the trial never happens. Betty's pattern of criminal behavior and evidence has all come to light, and it's overwhelming. The checks that were forged, the bloody pillowcases, the borrowed chainsaw, the toxicology reports of Barbara Smith, and having the literal keys to the storage locker where Marlon Keith Smith's body is found are damning.
7 months after Betty's sanity hearing, she pled guilty to manslaughter as part of a plea agreement. She also pled guilty to attempted second-degree murder for the poisoning of Barbara Smith, 16 counts of fraud, as well as obstruction of justice for lying to investigators about the phone calls to Keith. This is a long list of offenses, and they're serious offenses, so the expectation is here that Betty will spend a long time in prison.
In the end, Betty is convicted of second-degree murder and receives a sentence of 48 years hard labor.
Betty appeals her sentence, arguing that it was unconstitutionally excessive and that the trial court failed to consider her mental illness. But the decision is affirmed. According to the sheriffs of the Grant Parish Sheriff's Department, Betty is now a pastor in the prison. Authorities are concerned about this as she is considered to be extremely manipulative.
The small community of Dry Prong has to get past this horrible crime. These are things that typically happen in the big city, but here in a small community, it's difficult to get past it, but ultimately the community has to move on.
Despite witnessing a horrific chain of events, Dry Prong continues as it had. It's a bastion of the quiet life, a peaceful place to raise a family and to go fishing. Sometimes the well comes up dry, as it did so many years ago. But it's still a great place to call home.